Hi there, and welcome to Online Gods, a podcast about digital cultures in India and beyond. This month, we're talking with Eugenio Gagliardone about technopolitics and with Swati about Indian atheists. I'm your host, Ian Cook. People believe certain things, and once a belief sets in, it's very hard to shake it out of someone. People believe in God or gods for sure, but people also believe in technologies, what technologies can do, and what groups, companies, or countries do with such technologies. In this episode, I suppose it's belief that ties things together. As with every podcast, first we speak with a scholar about a key concept or theme, and then we go on to speak with an online god, someone who's using new media in innovative or influential ways. This month, our scholar is Eugenio Gagliardone, who will talk to us about technopolitics, specifically in relation to China's involvement in African countries in regards to internet and communication technologies. And then our online god is Swati, one of the admins from the Facebook page Indian Atheists. And this podcast is part of a wider project on digital dignity led out of LMU Munich by Sahana Urpa, who will be joining me as a co-interviewer for the first interview. Okay, let's get on with the podcast. Eugenio Gagliardone is Senior Lecturer in Media Studies at the University of Witwatersrand. He is also an Associate Research Fellow in New Media and Human Rights at the Programme in Comparative Media Law and Policy at the University of Oxford. His research focuses on the use of information and communication technologies for development, the international politics of the internet, and the use of old and new media for political change in sub-Saharan Africa. His new book, China, Africa, and the Future of the Internet, is out now with Zed Books. And we are really happy to have Eugenio on the podcast. Thanks so much for coming on Online Gods.
Thank you for having me.
And Sahana is with us as well. Hi there, Sahana.
Hi. Thanks, Eugenio. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Great. Okay, let's jump in. Maybe to start with picking apart one of the concepts that we're going to talk about today. So, in your work, you explore internet and communication technologies (ICTs) in various African countries: Kenya, Ghana, Ethiopia, and Rwanda, and specifically in relation to China's involvement in this sector. And I want to dig a little bit into China's role in a while. But before we get there, we want you to unpack a little bit the idea of technopolitics and technopolitical regimes. These are the two of the concepts that you use in your work. So our first question is, how do you understand the concept of technopolitics, and how does it allow us to better understand China's interventions in Africa's communication technologies?
Well, the concept of technopolitics is not a concept that I created, but I borrowed it from historians of technology. And I thought it was particularly interesting and important to look at information and communication technologies because of the kind of presentism that has affected a lot of research. And being able to locate what many calls new technologies into a longer term space in connection with other technologies, I think allows us to, first of all, better understand how they interact with existing power structures and infrastructures, and also to avoid the mistakes that we have seen in the past 20 years expecting revolutionary transformations that actually either have taken much longer to become real or had taken very different direction from what was expected earlier on. And I think it's particularly interesting and revealing to look at China for a set of reasons. The idea of technopolitics, in a nutshell, tries to look at the evolution of a specific technology. In my case, I've been focusing on the internet, but historians of technologies have been looking at any kind of technology, from nuclear power to military and aeronautical technologies and so forth. And we, through the lenses of technopolitics, we can see the evolution of the technologies as networks of different elements. Three key networks are networks of technologies, obviously, and networks of discourses, and networks of actors. And when it comes to China, one of the paradoxes is that while Chinese technology has, especially in Africa, the space where I have been doing most of my research, have become increasingly pervasive, China has been quite silent when it comes to discourses about spinning its own model. So for those who have been looking at Chinese influence in Africa, and but without doing research on it, without looking at the empirical evidence, so I'm talking about pundits, some Western NGOs and politicians, there has been consistently this accusation that China is trying to export its model abroad. But if we actually look at official documents, proclamation, there is very little, almost nothing coming from China and trying to support a specific idea of the internet or ask other countries to embrace a model of the kind that China has developed within its national borders. So if we unpack and we disconnect the technology and the discourses, we see very different pictures. But then the idea of technopolities allow, once we have done this analysis, to connect them together. So what we have seen, for example, and here's where the actors come in, China's also tended to work with specific actors, mostly governments. And governments are just one of the many players in the setting up of information societies. If we look at how information societies evolve globally, governments have played a big role, but obviously the private sector has also played a big role. And the civil society has played a big role at different points of time. So if one powerful actor, China, works with just one of these players, it end up creating possibly an imbalance of powers in envisioning information societies. So if we, rather than assuming that China is supporting a model discursively, technologically, and politically, if we unpack these and then reconnect it together, we have a more nuanced picture that tells us more of the strategies used by a specific player in order to achieve a specific goal. And these, I think, where a concept of technopolitics is relevant and is important to study this specific phenomenon.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for that. I was wondering, like, so you've mentioned China, and you've mentioned the sort of discourses that usually abound in popular press and amongst maybe some political pundits. I mean, and certainly for those of us who aren't, you know, deeply engaged in the topic, and we see this on the news, this sort of very sort of simplistic narrative that, you know, Chinese imperialism is taking place, and very often it's set against this idea of the sort of African countries sort of shorn of any sort of agency as the Chinese come in. And that's one of the reasons why we're really happy to have you on the podcast to complicate this a little bit. So I was wondering, could you please unpack a little bit more how different African private companies, civil society organizations, and also state institutions interact with both the Chinese government and Chinese companies in the ICT sector?
Well, as I try to do in some of my work, I highlight how if we pitch the analysis at different sector, we have at different levels, we can get somehow different pictures. So if we look at a macro level, the level of large regimes and ideas of the internet, it's somehow true that two competing conceptions have been emerging at least in the past 10 or 15 years. So one is the somehow original ideas of the internet as in one network that allows people to communicate across borders. And this was pushed very much by the United States and by a coalition of actors, governments, civil society organization, and private sector. And on the other end, there has been a growing emphasis on the side of China on this idea of sovereign internet. Every country should be allowed to develop its own internet, which goes against, is not the same thing as China trying to push its own model. It's just trying to support a different conception, and is that led to individual socio-political formation to create and develop. When we move actually at the meso level, and meaning like the level of individual states, the narrative of African states lacking agency, actually it's not just wrong, but it's really deceiving. What I have seen through my analysis of two authoritarian regimes in Africa, Ethiopia and Rwanda, and two more democratic countries, Kenya and Ghana, is because of the increasing presence of China as a big new player in the scene, African governments have been able to play different actors one against the other, or to mix and match different technologies in order to achieve their own specific vision of the information society. So in the case of Ethiopia, the Ethiopian government had a very stubborn project of trying to expand access in the regime of monopoly. And without the support of China, this could have never happened, and both financially and technically. But then if we move to Kenya, which is a very liberalized space, and where many different players, China has supported just a limited number of projects in competition with others. So we see what actually matters in at least in the countries where I did most of my fieldwork is a very specific and relatively unique image and vision of the information society that has emerged locally, and then China is added later on as one of the components of this bigger project. So actually, China has increased agency in the information space. And as I said earlier, the only problem is whose agency is actually being boosted. The problem with narratives that are not nuanced or not based on empirical evidence is they say, well, China is working with African countries. But what is an African country? In Kenya, there is a very vibrant civil society that has played an incredibly important role in shaping specific aspect of the internet. In Ethiopia, this civil society has been silent. And just now, in the past year and a half, since the new prime minister came to power, we have a different picture. So we also have to unpack these entities that usually are left considered as unitary. And then the final bit, which actually goes a little bit against what I said when it comes to the macro level and the micro and the meso level, if we look at the micro level, the level of the individuals, the story seems a bit different, because at the end of the day, China is the Chinese government and Chinese company are very big players. And in the past 5 to 10 years, we have seen other big players increasing their capacity and their power in almost every country. And I'm talking about the Facebook and Google and the like. So what we have, if you look at how the internet is evolving from the perspective of individual users, and on the one end, you have an image of expanded access, expanded opportunities, but also the weakening of the position of smaller entities, individuals or groups, to actually shape information societies in their own countries. Because on the one hand, you have the big corporate players. On the other, you have the big public actors, sometimes empowered by China. And so the opportunities to reshape the internet that were so much part of the initial mythology of the internet, the initial narratives, are actually reducing drastically. And so you see this kind of like unholy alliance between China as a powerful state actor and other very powerful corporate actors that actually are coalescing against the possibility of changing the rule of the game that has been so much part of the internet, at least at its beginnings.
Absolutely, Eugenio. I think it's very important to take agency seriously and locate agency at different levels. But big players are also shrinking these spaces and possibilities for action. So how do you see shifting geopolitics affecting data mining, data being the new oil, China being a giant game changer, and so on? Also, we've been talking about data surveillance from the lens of Silicon Valley corporations. How do you see the scenario changing with China emerging as a significant player in Africa? You mentioned China is pushing for data sovereignty. How do you see the tension between data sovereignty and surveillance capitalism?
Right. I think there was a defining moment a few years ago where the balances of power over the internet and the conflict of different models emerged. I want to say quite clearly, but if analyzed properly, they show a kind of bleak picture, but that needs to be brought to light a bit more. So I think we have to go back to 2012. There was a conference organized by the International Telecommunication in Dubai, and this conference was pitched as the fight, as a kind of the beginning of a new Cold War over the internet. And there were coalition coming, especially from the West, trying to depict China as this evil mastermind of an authoritarian conception of the internet. And the campaign was actually called Hands Off the Internet. So there was this kind of pitching of the good and the bad. China was at the center of the coalition of the bad governments, and a lot of them were also in Africa. And the West was trying to defend this idea of the internet. But then, if we look at what happened just a couple of days before this conference, where there was a kind of a smaller gathering, less visible, still organized by a subunit of the Information Telecommunication Union on deep packet inspection. Deep packet inspection is technology that allows to control and in real time what individuals are communicating, what they are doing over the internet. Big division between the free world and the unfree world actually collapsed. And everybody very quickly agreed that deep packet inspection could become a recognized standard at a global level. So on the one end, you have like the big corporate agents that have an interest in deep packet inspection because of ability of playing with the speeds at which they offer different kind of services and content and getting out of networks those who are using like peer-to-peer networks and so forth, and the like of China that are interested in this packet inspection more for political reasons. So surveillance capitalism and a different kind of surveillance actually connected and agreed for a vision where, as I said earlier, big, powerful actors are much more in control of what can be done, possibly for different reasons. One, for like harvesting data that can be sold to companies and advertisers. The other one, to ensure that the internet is not going to have a disruptive effect on the social fabric. But the technical tools that are being used in order to achieve these goals are very similar. And so this kind of illusion of the Cold War and disappears, and possibly the results is more frightening.
That's quite worrying. Because of these developments, I feel technopolitics is an important concept to work with. It is a useful framework to study many other cases and not just the cases you've covered, Eugenio. So let me push the conceptual issues a little more here. One of the key challenges is to see technological artifacts and affordances, whether they are interactive designs of social media or algorithmic filters or interlocks, as having some sort of influence beyond the control of users. We don't have to see users as puppets to appreciate the influence of these artifacts and design features. On the other hand, as you've shown so well, the same technology can be captured by competing actors and discourses. So the question is, how do we develop a critique of technology that has planetary scope and reach without losing sight of the diversity of actors and political contexts? Or to say it somewhat dramatically, can we critique Facebook as an artifact beyond how political groups in India or Ethiopia or the US put it to use?
Well, I find it fascinating in the practicalities of doing research, how the concept of technopolitics sort of forces you to plunge into a technical artifact. And it's particularly helpful when you look at the evolution of technology on a national scale. But then when I started looking at China, as we discussed earlier on, I could see also the advantages of bringing a comparative angle to the analysis of technology. So the first time they used technopolitics, it was in the case of Ethiopia, and it was fascinating to see how political ambition had to interact with technologies in very precise ways. So the initial ideas that I followed through multiple interviews and over a long period of time is having politicians thinking that technology could do magic. And then actually interacting with the real limits of technology. And it was fascinating to see and to follow how the very same politicians had to come to term with the constraint of technology, but at the same time, technology forced them to really reflect on what mattered to them. And so it was a fascinating way to follow and to dig deep into the political imagination of specific actors that couldn't have everything. And when it comes, in the case of Ethiopia, to deciding what mattered, the idea was having a technology based still on the internet that was not allowing multiple ways of communicating and back and forth, but was actually enabling people at the center of power to reach out to the peripheries of the state to a very large plasma TV screen and instruct individuals in very remote areas about politics and policy. And it was fascinating, again, the idea of history comes to the fore, to see not how the newness of the technology matter, but actually the ideological frameworks that developed, again, in the case of Ethiopia, during the guerrilla struggle that started, that lasted for 20 years. There's a specific imagination of how a vanguard, we're going back to Marxist ideology, can connect with the masses that was experimented in the 1970s and 1980s in a very face-to-face and physical manner, is still what shaped later on the construction of very complex technological artifacts and using the internet protocol to put the very face of the prime minister in front of the faces of different kind of individuals, bureaucrats, political representatives in very remote areas. And so this is, I think, the fascination of a concept like this taken to the ground. When going back to your question about how do we look at these globally, it seems at the beginning I was also a bit skeptical that this concept that has proved very helpful on a national scale could be taken to a larger scale, but actually it allowed to see connecting political ideologies and specific technical decision to see how countries that actually look quite similar could develop very different technopolitical regimes, and understanding that in each specific case, the reason could be either technical or discursive or dependent on what is the specific power balance or imbalance at a point in time. Using another example, the country that probably is the closest politically to China, even if the scale is very different, is Rwanda, where there is a Marxist-Leninist ideology, a very strong presence of the state and legitimacy of the state, actually didn't collaborate with China, but collaborated with South Korea when it came to developing their own technopolitical regime. So in that case, the actor really matter, and the outcomes were influenced by that. So and I think it's also a conversation that we are having, you and I, Sahan, about is it possible if we adopt a kind of a technopolitical framework in a broad variety of countries to start like seeing conjunctures and similarities across those that are not simply an expectation of the kind like China is going to export its model, but are more empirically grounded and distilled from a broad variety of factors that can be influencing a specific outcome, but we see across democracies and autocracies alike, and different type of mantra. So at that point, we can sort of claim with greater legitimacy that a trend is happening, not because we try to study the trend, but just because even if we use an open framework, these are the elements that emerged and are similar across different sociopolitical formations.
Wonderful. I feel like the party pooper to sort of slowly wind this interview towards an end, because it's been really interesting. But I want to ask you the final question, which we ask all of our guests, and that's about the idea of digital dignity, which is something that we find as a useful concept in motion that we're thinking through with various guests in this podcast. So I'm wondering, thinking about your own work, what might digital dignity mean?
Well, probably the research project that I was involved in and that tied more clearly to the idea of digital dignity was in Ethiopia just before the election in 2015, when with a large group of researchers, we were exploring online conversations, mostly on Facebook. And we came with an assumption that because of the political polarization that had happened in Ethiopia, where different political formation refused to recognize one another as legitimate, that we would have found a lot of online vitriol and an absence of dignity and mutual recognition among different actors. Actually, what we found was somehow surprising, and there was a much greater sense of respect when it came to individual users than we hypothesized we could find at the beginning. So on the one end, we because of the visibility of online vitriol, because of somehow the brutal framework that are being used by visible individuals, politicians in many parts of the world. Europe right now sees a resurgence of a very undignified right. We would expect that also the ordinary conversation go in that direction. And actually, research shows a different picture. As one of the other guests of your podcast, Daniel Miller, said, if we come and try to look for something specific, and we will probably find it. The beginning of this project that was externally funded was just focusing on online hate speech. And we resisted it, saying, well, if we've just focused on online hate speech, we will find a lot of it probably, and we will give the impression that the online speech is what dominates conversations in Ethiopia. And we succeeded in convincing our funders to look at all conversation happening on Facebook in Ethiopia in a particular time frame, and the story that we could tell was a much more dignified one, one where there was definitely a fraction of the population that was refusing to recognize each other, that where online vitriol was dominant and quite brutal, but it was a huge variety of conversation where individuals from different ethnic groups, different genders and different backgrounds actually recognized each other and wanted to engage into the conversation. So this just simply reaffirms the importance of actually breaking the stereotypes and getting into empirical evidence to have a better picture of what is actually going on.
That's very reassuring as well, Eugenio.
Yes, I like to end on a positive note after having depicted a lot of bleak scenario earlier, and I still want to be an optimist sometime.
In this middle part of the podcast, I want to tell you that we are part of the wider initiative For Digital Dignity. Go to fordigitaldignity.com or check out the Facebook page For Digital Dignity. If you want to get in touch, then email me at onlinegodspodcast@gmail.com or tweet at me at Ian Mick Cook. I should also tell you that the project, officially called Online Our Poll, has received funding from the European Research Council Starting Grant Agreement number 714285 and is led by Sahan Udapa, Professor of Media Anthropology at the Department of Social and Cultural Anthropology at LMU Munich. Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. Next, we're going to turn to Indian Atheists. This is a Facebook page, but behind the Facebook page is a community that seeks to bring together a community of Indian atheists and to build a society based on science, reason, and humanistic values. Over 280,000 people like the page, which is a collection of news stories, memes, videos, text, and so on, all that critique religion, many different forms of religion in many different fashions. And I am really happy to say that it's our pleasure to have Swati from Indian Atheists on Online Gods. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Great. I want to start with a very general question about motivation, I suppose. Why do you do what you do?
I think one of the primary factors is that atheism in India is still an up-and-coming subject. Some would argue that there are aspects of certain religions that already promote an atheistic school of thought. But the fact of the matter is that people are still hesitant to sort of broach the subject. And one reason why we do this is so people who are on the fence or who are already closet atheists, so to speak, they find some space that resonates with them. And I suppose they're interested in building not exactly a community, but at least some sort of space that people can, you know, take some respite in knowing that they're not alone. Because my personal journey towards atheism was, you know, I was a very isolated sort of voice in this. And I used to question myself a lot about why I'm feeling these things and going against the tide and is there something wrong with me. So personally, it would have helped me to have something like this during that time. And so it's really just an effort to sort of make people feel less alone. And that's one part of it for sure. And that's why I personally do it.
Interesting. It's interesting that you say you want to create a community for people who are on the fence or closeted atheists or so on. And I'm thinking that often online interactions are not the place where people can always be the most honest, because very often, you know, people can be trolled or people can be attacked very, very quickly and so on. So I'm just wondering how then as a page or as a movement, how do you then manage to, or how do you try to create a community where people feel free to ask questions or be unsure or, not fully have decided on something?
Okay. So the page itself, because of the restrictions that Facebook itself as a platform imposes, there's not much we can do as a page, but we do have other groups on Facebook with very strict guidelines and rules of admission. So we don't just let just about anyone in. And while we do acknowledge that debate is essential, we try to keep debate groups separate from safe groups, so to speak. So in the safe group, we ensure that people at least agree on some base level things. So atheism itself, for example, cannot be debated on the safe group. In the debate group, of course, it's allowed and it's very strictly moderated. So we don't really, we can at least try and control the quality of debates. We try to make sure that, you know, the amount of trolling and everything is lessened. Mm-hmm. One thing is moderation. I mean, you do need moderators constantly to be available on these platforms, because the numbers just keep going up every day. And it's a tough job, but I think it's worth it even if one person, as a result of it, takes something back home from it. So that's really the motive here for me.
You mentioned some other pages, and I know from reading your history that somehow you came out of a larger group called Nim Ukta. And I'm wondering, could you tell us about a little bit about the history of the page and and about your relationship to this big wider movement?
Right. So Nim Ukta was actually an effort to talk about rationalism and free thought in general and spread that message in India. it was founded by this man called Ajita Kamal, which is not his real name, but he used to go by that name. And I was actually a very late entrant into the Nirmukta circle. I think I found it about 2 years after its inception. So, but the history goes like this. It was a very dangerous time back then, I suppose, for people to be coming out of the woodwork and talking about these subjects. And, you know, religion is a very touchy subject, especially in a country like India. So, but he used to really be passionate about talking about free thought and rationalism and having a healthy amount of skepticism when you approach things and things like that. And a few years later, he just kind of disappeared. We don't know what happened to him. There's been no news of where he went, or we don't even know if he's around or not. So we tried to keep Nirmukta alive in his honor. And we try to do some of the same things. Of course, it evolved a lot from what it was back then, because, you know, a lot of people don't acknowledge some parts of humanism when it comes to, I mean, they're interested in the rationality and all and atheism, but these are sort of low-hanging fruits for the everyday woke boy kind of a person. When it comes to other issues like caste-based violence or sexism or misogyny and homophobia and things like this, these were still uncharted territories as far as a lot of rationalist groups were concerned. And Nirmukta's effort has been towards consolidating all of these together and, you know, creating a space where people can really open up about these things and not feel unsafe. So I feel like we've really gotten to a point where, you know, we are recognized as a group that at least some of those people can feel safe in. So I think that's what we're most proud of. Indian Natives is a faction that's separate, that's a part of the Nirmukta. It kind of branched out. And Indian Natives also focuses on these issues in part, which a lot of people don't like. They've accused us of, you know, posting stuff that's in no way, shape or form related to atheism in their opinion. Uh-huh. But we try not to box ourselves into that. There are other pages that only talk about atheism, and, you know, they, but I think we're a little different in the sense that we do talk about socio-political issues as well, sometimes. Mm-hmm. Not in depth and not very seriously, but we do share news articles and memes and things like that, which are relevant to those causes also.
Hmm. Could you give me an example of the sort of thing that you shared that people said wasn't to do with atheism and that you shouldn't be sharing it or shouldn't be posting it?
For example, we had made a few posts about caste-based issues. Mm-hmm. And it was actually very interesting to me to see that people thought this has nothing to do with atheism, because caste is an inherent facet of the Hindu religion. And people will probably call me out on this, and they will say that's not so and all that, but it is true, it's there. People can get defensive about it all they like, but it's interesting to me to see that people don't associate caste with religion, and they think that it's got nothing to do with Hinduism, and they find it weird that we post about it and we critique it and we say that, you know, it needs to be abolished. So that's one example. And sometimes we make political posts. We are critical of the establishment that we live under, and people have a problem with that too. So if we say something that's anti-establishment, they say that this has got nothing to do with this atheism, so you shouldn't be talking about this. So yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's just to continue on this thread about then politics. I mean, if your mission more broadly is mm-hmm. to get more people either to become atheist or at least to start to think about these things, and at the same time it becomes extremely partisan and people really become quite blind, shall we say, in when if they think that something is anti the party or the group that they like. So I'm wondering, like, how careful or not? Are you, when it comes to this, like, do you say, you know what, if somebody who's associated with whatever political party is, you know, using religion in a certain way and this is something you dislike, you're like, okay, we have to say it? Or do you worry, or do you think, okay, maybe we shouldn't alienate people because actually our mission is not anything to do with necessarily party politics, and we want to try and separate those to try and bring more people in to the to atheism?
So I would say that it's not a matter of how careful we are. We just don't think that neutrality is an option in the times that we live in, and in fact we think that neutrality is actually just, you know, a code word for compliance towards all the bigotry that we see. And we do take strong stand. We don't think that we should, or that anyone should for that matter, not speak up when they see that something is very wrong and it's happening right in front of their eyes. So Indianators have been banned temporarily from Facebook a few times. You know, we have hit these snags, but we try to not let that get in the way of what we do, because I don't think that silence and, you know, towing the line between what's okay to say and what's safe to say and bordering on the edge of, you know, what is bold, so to speak, I don't think that that's an option for us anymore. And at Indianators, I think we think that safe stances are really not stances at all. So we don't really try to toe that line. We take a stand and then we stick with it.
Changing track a little bit, I want to talk about the form of social media, like, and how it allows you to work or how it limits your work in certain ways. I mean, do you think there's something particular about social media, and obviously you're a Facebook page, or maybe primarily Facebook, that allows you to be effective in the work that you do?
Right. This actually is one of my favorite things to talk about, because I don't know if you've heard of this term, slacktivist. I'm sure you must have come across it somewhere.
Yeah.
But a lot of people criticize people for using social media for their activism. And they say that it doesn't really translate into anything in the real world. And I think that, I don't know if I'm allowed to cuss on your show, but I think that's really stupid.
That's not a swear word.
I think that social media is a really good to get people together. There has been revolutions that have started on social media. And, you know, what I really especially like about its form is that when you do your activism, you know, if you say go out and have a conference or talk about these things, you do some actual social responsibility activities somewhere, that of course makes an impact, and that is and should be the end goal. But on social media, I think that the all the posts that you have and everything that you say, you are spreading awareness of it and you are talking to people about it, you're reaching out, but at the same time, you're building this body of work. There's this huge repository of resources that people can access at any point in time, and they can check back and they can read about it. And I think it's a great platform with a lot of interactions, and then not just your content, but, you know, the things that people say in response to your content. And I think that building that body of work that really speaks for what you do and that's a resource for people to later fall back on, that really helps, because, I think it's important to document what you do and to sort of have that handy. So, because when you're backed by a lot of information, I don't think there's any better validation for what you do, because you're sticking to facts and you're sticking to, you know, things that are objective and real, and that really helps you do what you do. So I think for me, that's my favorite part about using social media. Of course, the end goal is to, you know, use it as a call to action platform where you can tell people to join you and do something in real time. And I think Indianators and Nirmukta as a whole has a long way to go towards that. We are still budding, I would say, in those respects. But I think that social media in and of itself is also a really great platform for this reason.
I mean, it's interesting that you're talking about that you have, I mean, and it's true, like when you start to click through the page and it takes you to outside links as well, that you have like a lot of like a repository or an archive, if you like, of the things that you've done and like, and like proving things and so on. And that's sort of the depth, I guess, of your work. Then I also think maybe there's something which is, I don't know whether it's contradictory to it or it pushes people, but the things that circulate most easily online are usually the, like, you know, the meme is the classic example, something which is just very, that people look at for a second, you know, and like and laugh and forward and then forget about it. So I'm wondering, do you think there's any tension between trying to create, I'd say, social change, which is what you're trying to do, and building this sort of deep thing, and the sometimes the need to be shallow or pithy or, sarcastic or something like that generates, you know, likes and clicks and shares and so on. Do you think there's a tension between the two?
So I think that yes, it is a tension. I mean, that is the reality of it. But I also think that if you use humor and memes responsibly, I think there's a lot of value in that, because oftentimes they do what lengthy articles and videos and, you know, nuanced debates on the subject, they don't really have the same effect, because we're living in a very attention deficit world. But if you use memes well, because they are shared so widely and they have the potential to go so viral, I think that you can really use it as a tool to make people think at the very least. And I think that's what we try to do. We're not interested in being edgy. We're not interested in, you know, being controversial for the sake of it. It's not our intention to provoke, although a lot of what we say is inherently provocative because of the circumstances that we live in.
Okay, thank you. I mean, as my final question, it's a question we ask all the guests on the project. It's about the idea of digital dignity, and this is something broadly we're trying to explore. And because you often have, I'm guessing you have a lot of interactions online in terms of debate and comments and so on. So I'm wondering, with your experiences of running the page, especially, do you think there's a possibility for dignified discussion and debate online in India today?
I think there is a possibility, but I think that it can only happen with a lot of rules and a lot of moderation from people who, you know, run said pages and groups. But I think we have managed to somehow do that in our groups, especially. What happens is that you run the risk of becoming an echo chamber when you clearly have, you know, certain tenets that you say are indisputable. So you run that risk. But I do think that it is possible to hold dignified conversations. And we see that happening in our groups. But I think it happens because we don't tolerate trolling. We don't tolerate any logical fallacies in any of our arguments, even if those arguments are, you know, we basically have the same stance towards those things that people say. But even so, if there's, you know, if there's any whataboutery or anything like that, for example, we don't tolerate those kinds of arguments. We care about the quality of discussion that we have. So I think that's my experience so far.
It's interesting. I know I said it's the last question. I just want to follow up on this. If you think more broadly then about, I don't know, debates that take place on Twitter or on Facebook, that where there's no moderation and no rules. It's just interesting because especially you say you're interested in making sure that people's arguments don't have logic fallacies or that people don't just engage in whataboutery. And I'm wondering if you were, and now I'm just thinking about if you can dream or so on, like if people, because I know a lot of people complain about the state of debate online because people just seem to be so free and easy to speak untruths quite happily, shall we say, like, because it just doesn't seem to matter anymore, right, whether something is true or not. I'm just wondering, like, could you imagine in general a way that debate online could be improved? Do you think, like, can you extend out the sort of rules that you have in your relatively small community to a wider place? Is it something that can be built into the architecture of debate?
Yes, I think that platforms implementing better policies for speech can definitely help with this. I am a huge proponent of that. And I know a lot of people are going to tell me, oh, but free speech and things like that. But that's, you know, telling someone that, for example, telling someone that hate speech is not going to be tolerated. If Twitter recently said that about transgender issues, for example, I don't think that's really putting a clamp on anyone's free speech, right? Because they're not going to jail for saying something. A platform is simply telling them that we don't want to listen to this. We don't want this on our platform. And I don't, free speech simply means that, you know, you're not imprisoned for what you are saying, which is happening to activists, by the way, in India. Mm-hmm. And there all the free speech proponents are really silent. But the point is that platforms deciding architecturally to improve the quality of discussions will definitely help. But I also think that, you know, if we just, I mean, unless someone, and if you have the emotional capacity to do it, and if you think that the other person genuinely is coming from a place of curiosity and not, you know, out and out vitriolic trolling, or if they aren't coming from that place, I think instead of calling them out, if you just call them in, and if you just treat that conversation with a little bit of empathy, I think it is a definite possibility that such platforms can, you know, really be a good space for fostering these discussions. I'm not yet a cynic, so I still believe in this.
Great. It's good to end on a positive note. Thank you so much, Swati, for coming on Online Gods.
Thank you so much.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Swati as much as I did. It's been a real pleasure having you as our listeners once again this month. Thanks so much for listening. Ta-ra. Thank you so much for listening to the Online Gods podcast. Online Gods is part of the project Online ARPOL, funded by the European Research Council, starting grant agreement number 714285. The project's PI is Sahana Udapa, who's Professor of Media Anthropology at the Department of Social and Cultural Anthropology, Ludwig Maximilian University, Munich, Germany. This podcast, like all the podcasts, is brought to you in collaboration with the HOW Network for Ethnographic Theory, my personal favourite network for ethnographic theory. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Goodbye.